12 years ago, Daniel Suelo quit money. Now, what I mean by quit money is he's got no bills, no mortgage, no job. He quit money. And for Daniel, it's freedom. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and on today's Central Standard, we'll retrace one man's radical transformation from a college graduate and hospital lab assistant to his life now, living in the rocky caves in the Utah canyons. Find out about how this self-proclaimed Vega bum goes day after day without a single solitary red cent to his name. Plus, author Mark Sundin joins the conversation to talk about writing The Man Who Quit Money, a book based on Daniel's life. Life in a Moneyless World on Central Standard after this hour's news. Good morning, Kansas City. We're about to hear a tale of strikingly Dickensian proportions. A tale of two men. One has a mortgage, investment property, tax returns, and the aspirational vigor that informs just about every American's life process. The other man hasn't changed hard currency in more than a decade. The other man doesn't barter, doesn't panhandle, doesn't borrow, and doesn't lend. The other man has quit money. This is Central Standard. I'm Jabalani LaFall, and we now welcome the first of these men, the taxpayer, Mark Sundin, the author of The Man Who Quit Money, which is about another man, the other man I mentioned, Daniel Suelo, who, like Buddha, Jesus, Gandhi, or what some call a transient, chooses to live an itinerant lifestyle without money. We'll talk to Daniel Suelo in a few minutes, but for now, Mark Sundin, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Why did you decide to write this book?
Well, you know, these ideas about living without money are things that have been interesting to me my whole life, but of course I've never pursued them. I've tended to live a more conventional life. And so when I heard about him, I saw, oh, here's a guy who's gone out and done these things that I'd dreamed about, and he's done them somewhat successfully.
But you knew him before he made this proclamation, right? Just seen him around in your vagabond
days.
Yeah,
he and I had worked together in a restaurant about 18 years ago. This is when he was still using money. And at that point, we were both pretty similar in our life paths. We'd both been to college and had kind of dropped out, I guess you might say, and were, you know, living very cheaply in a small tourist town working in a restaurant. But from that point, we diverged, as you said in your intro. You know, I went the way of the normal American consumer, and he went the way of that no one in this country lives.
What made you go back?
Well, I suppose just wanting security, fear of being out homeless. You know, when I was about 30, I decided to start writing full time, and I felt like I needed an office, and I needed a computer, and I needed internet, and so I started to, stop living in my car, which I had been doing very briefly in my early 20s.
Isn't it kind of ironically American and capitalistic that you're profiting off of a man who doesn't want, doesn't need, and doesn't use money? Isn't that an irony there?
Absolutely. You know, I think about that all the time. And basically, you know, I've had to come to terms with the fact that I work in a commercial art form. Journalism is not the kind of thing you can stay home and write as if you were a poet or a novelist. You need to travel. You need to do interviews. And so, of course, I accepted an advance from a publisher to go out and write this book. And it's just been an honor that Suelo allowed me to tell his story, because this is the kind of story that, as a journalist, you're always looking for.
Wait, so you're saying you get paid to write and get paid to be a journalist?
Absolutely.
Not
very much.
Right, right. You had a very telling.
I have other jobs, of course, to pay the bills, but this is a part-time job.
You had a very telling and shameful moment for yourself, which questioned your own ethics. When you saw Daniel Suelo again for the first time in years, he looked like what many would consider a bum, and you kind of recoiled at first. Tell us about that experience and what it taught you.
Yeah, I hadn't seen Suelo in about 3 or 4 years, and I was down in Moab, Utah, which is where we had known each other. And I bumped into him, and he'd gone gray, and he seemed to be missing a tooth. And I'd heard through the grapevine that he was living without money, and yet I hadn't seen him. But in my mind, I'd kind of figured he'd gone crazy. I mean, who lives without money? I'd heard he was living in a cave. I figured he'd lost it. And, you know, we kind of made eye contact. We didn't quite recognize each other. And then he smiled in recognition. And what I did was just turn and pretend I didn't recognize him and walk away. Because for me, there was something very threatening, or I felt like he was judging me. The fact that he lived without money, it made it seem like he was judging me for living with money. And I didn't want anything to do with him. And so I just turned and walked away.
What drew you back to the point where you felt it was important to chronicle this story and where you began to once again admire his path?
Well, about 3 years ago, a story was written about him in a magazine that really made an effort to understand why he was doing what he was doing. And it put it in context of the failure of the economy in 2008. And so when put in that way, you know, his main premise is that money is an illusion. And that sounds silly to most of us because we know even if a $20 bill is just a piece of paper, we can go exchange it for food or any other sort of product. So it's not really an illusion. But after the collapse of the economy, when maybe a $500,000 house was suddenly worth $300,000, we said, what happened to that other $200,000? Maybe that was an illusion. And so when I saw him in context of the larger economic forces and events, suddenly what he was saying started to make sense. And that was when I set out to write this book.
But you do, to some respect, agree that money is a sort of esoteric promise or abstract concept as outlined in some books by Griffin, such as Creatures from Jekyll Island.
That's right. The more research I did, the more I realized that Suela wasn't just some nut in a cave who had these crazy ideas. I saw that on both sides of the political spectrum, there were people who were really doubting the nature of money. They were saying this was an illusion. I mean, if you look at the Tea Party or the Gold Bugs, they're basically saying that the Fed is just waving its magic wand and dollars appear, and they don't really exist. They're just an abstraction or an agreed-upon fairy tale. And if you look at maybe, let's say, the Occupy movement, basically what they're saying is that our government is now beholden to banks as a result of this setup with the Fed, where the Fed creates money with its magic wand, and suddenly the taxpayers are in debt. And as a result, you know, we can't control Wall Street because it owns our government.
You make a very striking and compelling argument that trying to achieve a life of balance between the Daniel Suelos in the world and between the quote-unquote law-abiding citizens who live with money makes you a slave to both sensibilities. Talk about that.
Yeah, you know, I find that most of us who have kind of an ethical desire to live a good life, we do a lot of compromising. We say, okay, I'm going to have the house because I need it, but I'm going to try to be a conscientious consumer. I'm not going to buy products that are made in sweatshops or that are, you know, destroying the environment. And ultimately what that causes is a lot of anxiety. I mean, one of the things I talk about in my book is the more I learned about this great swirl of plastic in the Pacific Ocean, which is the size of Texas, and it's from mostly plastic bags, I started to become obsessed. You know, how can I stop contributing this? This is killing our ocean. This is killing all the seabirds and the fish, the dolphins. And, you know, so next thing I know, I'm washing Ziploc bags. And instead of feeling like I was doing something heroic, I felt like I was doing something very petty. And, you know, with Suelo, he's chosen not to compromise. He's chosen to do the most radical thing possible, which is cut himself out from the economy, cut himself out from all means of production. He doesn't bring any produced goods into the world. He only uses what's been thrown away by others or what is given freely by nature when he forages. And to him, that gives him peace. And I think to most of us who feel kind of in a constant struggle between getting what we need and doing what we think is right, we feel more anxious than ever.
It brings up a visceral reaction as you read this book, definitely. After seeing the profound effect Daniel had on some of the people who knew him and some of the people who didn't, what have you done differently with your own attitude towards money, if anything?
Well, I guess my attitude has been coming around to seeing this idea that money is an illusion and that the things that are real, which are our goods, and our services, our labor, you know, those are the things we need to value more. So ironically, for me, sometimes that might mean spending more money. You know, if I can buy a product that creates jobs in America for at a decent wage and doesn't pollute the environment versus buying a cheaper product that's made in a sweatshop in the third world and contributes to sort of an imperialistic way of living or degradation of the environment, I might spend that more money because I want to support the real things in life that I think are valuable.
You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Mark Sundin, who wrote the book, The Man Who Quit Money, which is about the life of Daniel Swalo, a man who lives in a cave in Utah and travels like a sort of modern-day sage. He dumpster dives and volunteer works for food and hasn't earned or spent a penny in about a decade. His life is the subject of the book, The Man Who Quit Money. Kansas City, would you ever consider living without money by choice, as our guest Daniel Swalo does? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up with questions for Mr. Swalo or Mr. Sundin at centralstandard@kcur.org. And now joining us is the one and only Daniel Swalo. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thank you for having me.
No problem. So you're calling from Moab, Utah, where there's a nearby cave that you make your home base.
Yes.
How is it living in a cave?
I love it. It's beautiful. I have a backyard that goes on for miles.
Right.
I feel like I live in more luxury than most people.
Right. Why did you quit money? That's the next question.
I quit money for a lot of different reasons. It's hard to pinpoint exactly one. I was raised in a very seriously Christian household, so I had the teachings of Jesus, and I often questioned, when I was a child, why we don't really keep the teachings of Jesus. So this stuff was in my head when I was a child. And then as I grew older and I left home, I studied other religions and found that other religions were teaching the same thing about it's the one thing that the world's religions agree upon, but very few people actually practice, and that is giving up possessions and doing for the sake of doing rather than for the sake of reward, which money represents.
Daniel, how do you feel about someone, not just anyone, but a friend, Mark Sundin, profiting off of your life when you've chosen not to? How did you reconcile that concept?
Well, I don't believe that money is evil. A lot of people think that I believe that. It is some strange part of our evolution, and I have to be realistic and say that everybody can't live without money right now. I do believe that it will go obsolete. It must if we're to survive. Yeah. And I realize that people need to make a living. I think that Mark deserves to have food on the table.
So you don't question anybody else's choice to live with money, and you
No.
ask that they not judge you to live without money.
Yeah, exactly.
We have one of our listeners, Courtney, who tweeted at KCURCST. That's our Twitter handle there. Honestly, I feel like I already do live without money. I'm sure a lot of Americans feel that way. Question for you, Daniel. In these tough economic times, what can people learn from your lifestyle that might help them? What do you think, Daniel?
I would say, bottom line, don't worry, that we live in a universe that it's an infinite universe that lives without money, except for our little commercial civilization. And you look at life all around us, and it functions beautifully and in balance without money. And this is the concept of our religious traditions, to have faith that everything we need comes in the present.
When you did indeed embark upon this journey, you did it with sort of detaching the need for an outcome and getting away from the fear of not having. Tell us about that transformation.
Yeah, before I gave up money, I did social work, and I worked with the homeless. And I often found myself terrified at the thought of becoming homeless. And then I analyzed that and thought, where does that fear come from? And I realized it's not the physical hardship, because I like challenges. I like going camping. I realized that the hardship was in my own thinking, worrying about what people think. And that is the thing that limits us the most, is just our own beliefs and our own thinking, not the physical reality.
You, of all people, know it's not about the destination, but about the journey. Let's talk about the several milestones that we learn about in the book, The Man Who Quit Money, and in the course of your life that led to your ultimate decision to quit money. Let's begin with your time in the Peace Corps. You discovered two things during your time in the Peace Corps. One, that you were gay and had to come out to your conservative Christian family, and the other, you ate a poison berry. Talk about that. Talk about those two pivotal moments.
Well, I actually ate several handfuls of poison berries.
Oh, there you go.
But yeah, I came out. It was a, when you're in a foreign country, you're back to being like a child, and you're learning your real self. And that's basically what this is about, is who is my authentic self? And living without money is part of that process. It's finding my authentic self. Part of that is being gay. And the idea of living without money is doing for the sake of doing rather than for the sake of appearance or for the sake of getting something in return, which I'd say is ulterior motivation. And it's strangely related. And of course, eating the poison berries is the same deal. It's like I hit bottom. I went into severe depression. So I was basically forced to completely accept my authentic self. And this has been a journey toward that.
Speaking of authentic selves, let's bring back in Mark Sundin for this part of the conversation. Did you go back to living Daniel's lifestyle with Daniel as you researched the book? And if yes, for how long? Just to get a sense of who he was, Mark Sundin.
You know, I have a house in Moab. And so when I went down there, I did spend a lot of time interviewing Daniel. And I spent a couple nights up in the cave with him. But for the most part, I felt that I was more interested in doing interviews and finding out his life story. As it turns out, I spent 11 years working as a wilderness guide, so I understood living outside.
You had your feel of that.
Yeah.
Talk about the turning point when Daniel attempted suicide driving off that cliff. First, you, Daniel, what did it teach you? And then, Mark, how did you shape this into a pivotal point in the story?
Well, I figured I was in such severe depression that killing myself was the one thought that gave me happiness. Like nothing else would bring happiness. That was the one thing that I thought, that this is my escape. And I wanted it to be fail-safe. And it actually failed, and I was astonished. And what I learned was that we have our place in this life, and we must accept it. We must embrace it. We can't run from it. The more we run from it, the worse it gets. So I was placed in that position, or I put myself there, of realizing I have no other choice but to accept where I am and who I am. And that's what that taught me.
You miraculously survived that driving the car off the cliff. Did you feel you had any greater purpose after that? Did you say, oh, okay. All right, God, you got me. Now I got to do this for real.
Yeah, I definitely felt that. And it was not a feeling of, like, I always wanted to, like, hear the voice of God, you know. And basically, I heard it, and I did not like it. I was so pissed off that, wow, I'm still alive, and now I'm forced into this mission, if you want to call it that. And it took me years to really embrace that and to find joy in it.
Another point in your life where you sort of tested the mettle of nature and tested your own resolve was your sort of Survivor Alaska experience. Tell us about what happened in Alaska with you and your companion, Ander, and where your philosophies were truly put to the test. Tell us about that in the Alaskan wild.
Yeah, I had worked in Alaska on the docks. I was slinging fish. I was at the bottom of the barrel, and I felt like my bosses were not treating their employees right, and I was getting paid very little and feeling disgusted, and I ended up walking off the job. And I decided to go out into the wilderness and live off the land, and I only brought enough food for a couple of days. And then when I ran out of food, I started eating berries and tried to catch fish. And then this Ander came along. He's a Basque person from Spain. And he asked me if I wanted to spear fish. So I felt like that was miraculous that he came along right at that time. So we basically lived off the land together for several weeks. And then we crossed a glacier to the other side of a river. It's kind of like the Into the Wild story. And then the rains came and the river rose and we couldn't get back across. And basically we both almost died. And that was another near-death thing that put me face to face with reality. And I started feeling an exhilaration and a joy of facing such obstacles. But also Ander and I talked incessantly about a world without money and how is it that nature is so beautifully balanced without money and living off the land. And then we hitchhiked after we went out of the wilderness and found astounding generosity and amazing synchronicities from just people. Creatures in nature and people outside of nature, we found this generosity, and all of this was just incubating these ideas of living without money and the possibility of a world without money.
You also had a very serendipitous moment with marshmallows. Tell us about what happened with the marshmallows. You were telling Ander about s'mores, which he, as a Basque from Spain, didn't know existed. And so what happens when marshmallows just miraculously, the universe supplies marshmallows? Talk about that.
Oh, yeah, that was pretty funny. We were, that whole day we were talking about how everything we need is in the present moment and a world without money. And then in the evening around the fire, by the fire, we were talking about our diets, like Christmas dinner and talking about, you know, nostalgia for all these things we grew up with. And he was telling me about Basque food, and I was telling about American tradition foods. And somehow we got into s'mores also. I was trying to tell him what s'mores were because we had a fire there. And I was like, it'd be nice if we had marshmallows and chocolate and graham crackers. You know, and then he was talking about how he wanted coffee and chocolate. And he was asking me what a marshmallow was, and I couldn't describe it to him. My Spanish wasn't that good. And I said, well, maybe I'll show you. Once we get out of here, I'll show you what a marshmallow is. And then it rained all night, and we were huddling in our tents. And we left our dishes by the lake shore. And in the morning, the rain had stopped, and we were packing up, ready to move out. And I went to the lake shore and saw a paper bag. It was like a grocery bag that was perfectly dry, so it hadn't been sitting there all night. And I peeked in it, kind of, and it looked like there was food in there. And I brought the dishes back, and I was a little bit pissed off. And I was like, wow, Ander's been holding off. He's been hoarding food or, you know, had all this food that we didn't know about. And then he went and saw the same bag, and we both looked at each other kind of with dirty looks. And then he brought it and set it by the tree. And then I asked him, is that your bag? And he said, no, I thought it was yours. And then we opened it up, and start pulling food out, and the first thing we pulled out was a bag of marshmallows. then a bag of chocolate-covered espresso beans, and then there were, like, packaged Indian curry and Thai food down at the bottom, and we were just, like, amazed.
So the only thing that was missing was the ray of light.
Yeah, the ray of light.
Melissa from Shawnee, welcome to Central Standard.
Hi, thanks. Excuse me, I just wanted to say I really admire and respect your lifestyle and would hope to live a lifestyle closer to that someday. But what would you do if you developed a really serious illness that you couldn't help with plants or natural medicine?
Well, that's a good question that comes up very often for you, Daniel Suelo. Melissa from Shawnee asked, what would you do if you developed an illness? And what would you do for a mom who feels trapped because she has to have things for her kids, such as health insurance? She admires your lifestyle, but there are sort of modern trappings that encumber her from going all the way.
Yeah, well, I basically, this is an experiment for my own life, and I don't impose it on anyone else. I don't judge other people for having health care or using government assistance or whatever. But as far as my own life, I've decided to experiment with basic natural selection and faith. I feel like I feel like when I look at nature compared to human civilization, I don't see mass chronic illnesses. I don't see extremes of obesity and malnutrition. When was the last time that anybody ever saw a herd of wild deer that had obesity or malnutrition and chronic illnesses? And I thought about this. I thought, why is it that we, with all of our high technology, have such a battle with illness? And, of course, the flip side of that is people say, well, that's selection. If you are sick, you die. And then I think, well, why is that so bad? We're all going to die, every single one of us, and we pretend that death is not going to happen. But it's also natural. It's our core human nature to help each other out. And I decided if services are freely offered without expectation of reward, just basic human compassion, then I would accept that. If a doctor or nurse or whoever comes along and I broke my leg or whatever, got some kind of illness, and they assisted me, I would take that freely. But I decided I didn't want to take health services where someone is paid to do it. And if I don't heal on my own, or if I don't receive assistance from my fellow human beings, then I decide I'll just accept it. And this is what happens in tribal societies. We look at it as barbaric, but like the Inuits, Eskimos, when a person got so old that she lost her teeth or whatever, she'd decide, okay, I'm just going to go out and sit on a slab of ice in the lotus position until I freeze to death, and a polar bear comes and gets her. And it's for the best for the tribe. It's best for natural selection. It's best for the natural balance. And of course, this is all ideas in my head. You know, when I'm faced with reality, we'll see what happens. But I have been sick a few times. I had the flu for 3 weeks. I felt like West Nile virus or something. And
We'll talk more about that when we take a quick break. Our guest is author Mark Sundin, who wrote The Man Who Quit Money, and we'd like to thank you for joining us and have you come back for this second part of the hour. And we've just been talking to Daniel Suelo, a man who fully believes and fully lives up to the term natural selection. He lives in a cave in Utah and travels like a sort of modern-day sage, dumpster diving and volunteering working for food, and hasn't earned or spent a penny in about a decade. We return with both Mark Sundin and Daniel Suelo, the man without money, the man who quit money, and we'll hear more about his philosophies and hopefully from you too if you'd like to comment. Kansas City, would you consider living without money by choice as our guest Daniel Suelo does? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. That's 816-235-2888. And you could also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. And welcome back to Central Standard. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Jesus Christ of Nazareth once said, "The foxes have holes and the birds of the sky have nests, but the Son of Man has no place to lay his head." And now we're back with the man who once had an evangelical Christian ask him, "So you think you can live like Jesus, huh?" And our guest Daniel Suelo, when asked this, replied simply, "Well, don't you?" We continue our conversation with Daniel Suelo, a man who lives in a cave in Utah and travels like a rolling stone, hasn't earned or spent a penny in about a decade. He's the subject of the book, The Man Who Quit Money, written by Mark Sundin. Kansas City, would you ever consider living without money by choice, as our guest Daniel Suelo does? Give us a call at 816-235-2888. You can also hit us up at centralstandard@kcur.org. Mark Sundin, the author of The Man Who Quit Money, which is about Daniel Suelo. Daniel actually changed his name to Suelo, which in Spanish means soil. Tell us about that transformation, which is sort of a full name change, a full philosophy change, and how it weaves into the narrative.
Well, shortly after his stopping using money, which was in 1999 or 2000, he traveled to Oregon, and he worked as a forest activist, which is also known as a tree sitter. He was up on top of a tree to prevent it from being cut down, and he spent about 3 or 4 months up there by himself. And since what he was doing was illegal, they all went by fake names. And while he was up there, he became something of a local celebrity. He'd written a story and for the newspaper, and the police would come and tell him he was under arrest, and he wouldn't come down. And then finally he did come down, and at this point he was so well known by his alias that they told him he had to make up another one, otherwise he'd be arrested. And he just made up the name Suelo kind of on the spot. He saw it on a bumper sticker. And it's a nickname that has stuck with him over the years, so he tends to go by that now instead of his real name, which is Daniel Schellebarger.
A lot more catchy for what he does in terms of foraging and being a man with no money. Suelo has a nice flow to it.
Oh, yeah, and as a writer, I couldn't have bear the thought of using the word Schellebarger hundreds of times.
Speaking of you, Daniel Schellebarger, Suelo, take us to the night when you quit money. Set that scene for us.
Oh, let's see. I was hitchhiking with a Canadian woman, Lorelei. We were hitchhiking down from Nova Scotia, and I had $50 in my pocket as a backup. That was my little safety net. And we were both talking about just giving up money altogether and having a moneyless tribe. And she had more experience than I did of like wandering and dumpster diving. She kind of helped me get over those little fears. But I kept having feelings of anxiety. We were hitching through New England, and I believe it was Pennsylvania. I kept thinking, why do I feel such anxiety about this whole thing? I noticed every time I felt anxiety, my mind was on my back pocket where the $50 was. And also my sister had been hounding me for a parking ticket that I had left in Seattle. I'd used her car. I don't know, it was like $20. And I decided I would mail her that money. And then I had the rest of this money in my pocket, and my mind kept going toward it, and I kept feeling anxiety. And then I realized that that was the source of my anxiety, that I was, why is $30 any more secure than no money? And I decided I just need to get rid of that because I'm putting my faith in this, these pieces of paper in my pocket instead of just trusting. So I went into a phone booth and I left the money in there on the top of the phone and walked out. And it was just this feeling of exhilaration. I felt like it was like this baptism, like warm water was pouring down on my head from above, and this feeling of total security and warmth, like it doesn't matter where I am, I'm at home. The whole universe is my home, so I can't leave home, and the whole universe is my security. And I didn't feel far away from home like I did just moments before.
You said something interesting, that money represents lack. Talk about that.
Yeah, it does. It. I also say that money represents everything except the present moment, and the present moment is the only reality. Money represents labor and services, goods of the past, and it represents potential in the future, like what you can buy. But if it actually represented itself in the present moment, it would not be money anymore.
It would be paper.
It would just be paper. It does not represent itself. And when we look at a bill, we don't see it for what it is. We see the potential. We see past labor and we see future potential. But very rarely do we say, wow, this is a nice picture of George Washington or Lincoln or whatever.
So debt and credit.
Yeah,
basically.
Debt and credit. Yeah, and debt and credit are lack. It's representing what's lacking in the present, that we don't have everything we need in the present.
Before we go to the callers that we have calling in to talk with the man who quit money, Daniel Suelo, let's bring back the author, Mark Sundin. What did publishers and agents think of this story when you were shopping this story to be published? It's very timely. What did they think?
Well, I guess the great irony is that I didn't shop them. They shopped me. There was a publisher in New York who read the original magazine article about Suelo and was just fascinated by him. And she wanted to do a book. And it was she actually wrote directly to Daniel and asked if he would like to write a book. And he said, maybe, but, you know, I would like it to be given away for free.
Like Abby Hoffman, steal this book.
Exactly. And the publisher, this is a big New York publisher, this is part of Penguin. You know, they couldn't figure out a way to give away a book, and it doesn't work with their business model. So the editor said, well, what if we had someone else write it? And because I had lived in Moab, they contacted me, and it was a pure coincidence that Daniel and I actually knew each other. And so Daniel agreed to do it, and one of the great things about this whole journey, this process, was he had asked them, and he didn't demand it or make a stipulation. He said, I would like it if the publisher would make some copies available for free. And over the course of the book tour we've done this year, the publisher agreed, and they gave away 700 or 800 books, and we would do these events at churches and schools or volunteer farms, libraries. And the publisher just sent out crates of books, and we gave them away for free, and it was all sort of to actually get in the spirit of this, and it was just so amazing and heartening to me to see a big, you know, publishing corporation actually put their money where their mouth is.
We're going to go to Daniel in Leawood, who has the namesake of our guest. Daniel in Leawood, meet Daniel Suelo in Moab, Utah. Welcome to Central Standard.
Hello, it's good to meet you.
Hi, Daniel.
Hi. I spent a lot of time in Moab for sports and for advertising. It's a beautiful area. I was calling because I wanted to know a little bit about your socioeconomic background. I also had the freedom, because of a safety net in my family, to be able to give beyond what normal people or a normal lifestyle could give, take a month or a year off and serve. And it was brought to my attention that it seemed very selfless, but that I also had a safety net in place that if something catastrophic medically or financially did hit me, or if I did need something, I wasn't quite as my wings weren't quite as broad as I pretended they were, because I did have family that could come in and help me if I needed it. Do you have any type of safety net, or what type of socioeconomic background, if I may ask, do you come from to be able to live so freely?
Very good question, one you probably get all the time. It's kind of like the Indian man who made himself a holy man that you encountered in India that actually had a Swiss bank account that he'd tap every once in a while.
Yeah.
Tell him about his question. Very good question.
Yeah, and people often ask me if I'm a trust funder or whatever. And my parents are on Social Security. They have no bank. They have no savings at all. They're barely eking by. I grew up in a lower middle class household. We had points when I was growing up where we lived in American suburbia, and then my dad had troubles with jobs, and we actually lived in a trailer a couple times.
We actually have a secondary conversation occurring in the background somewhere. Is there a second line where you are, Daniel?
Yeah, I hear that. I'm not sure what that is.
I can hear it, too, in Montana.
Calling in for the cave. Anyway, let's bring in Mark Sundin. Were you surprised that Daniel Suelo was extraordinarily social, given his choice of hermitage?
I was. I had assumed that he was a hermit because he lives in a cave. Of course, that's an obvious conclusion. And it turns out I don't think that's an accurate word. I mean, he does live alone, but he's incredibly social. You know, he volunteers at a community garden. He volunteers at a women's shelter. And he gets involved in local politics. And he has hundreds, if not thousands, of friends all across the country who he goes and visits. He hitchhikes around. He rides the rails. He's ridden his bike across the country. And, of course, through the miracle of the Internet, he goes to the public library, and which is free to all citizens, or even non-citizens.
So he doesn't get snail mail at the cave. He relies on email.
That's right. And, you know, he's got a blog that he writes about his life, and he's got thousands of followers worldwide who write him questions. And he spends a lot of his days in conversation online with people. And if, you know, people are interested in finding out more about this, they can go to quitmoney.net, which is a page I set up, which will have links to his blog, and it also has more about the book and people talking about this, because it does strike a chord with people. And sometimes that chord that it strikes is very positive. People are inspired. Other times it's really negative. People say he's a mooch and he's a cancer on society.
Right. Some people
and
hate him. And let's
yeah,
let's address
just,
that. Let's address that. Yeah. Daniel, what do you say to critics who think you're a loafer and need to get a job and participate in what the modern economy has provided us, for better or for worse, and those who say that you would never be able to live this way in another country because America is a land of plenty that throws away paninis and kale and stuff like that? What do you say to these criticisms?
Well, first of all, I would say that every single living being is a mooch. Everything that we receive is freely given, and it's collective. We receive sunlight for free. We receive air for free. The land that we live on was originally free, and somebody stole it and then decided, I'm going to charge rent for this land that I stole. So it's either given freely or stolen. And we have a hard time looking at ourselves and thinking, what is a mooch? Is a person working in a sweatshop in China or Indonesia less deserving of a decent housing and wage and food as the child that's playing with sweatshop toys here in America in suburbia and then gets bored with it and it goes into the dumpster?
That's not a question a lot of people are comfortable with answering.
Yeah. What is a mooch? And I would say, if you take more than you need, you are a parasite, or not even a parasite, a cancer. You are destroying your host organism, which is what we're doing with Earth. And why is it the people who take only what they need are called mooches? And am I taking only what I need, or am I taking more than I need? And who's being a drain on society? And also, I would say, I've traveled the world. I've been in so-called third world countries and here, and I find that it's pretty much a law that the less people have, the more they're willing to share, and the more they're willing to give. The more people have, the more they believe that they earned it, and the more waste there is, the more junk goes into dumpsters. So yes, I do live off of the opulence of this society, what is thrown away, what is wasted through moochism. And if I were in a poorer culture, such as the Native Americans before money hit the scene here, or in third world countries, people are more generous and sharing. So it all works out. There are people living moneyless in India, which is sadhus, and Southeast Asia, bhikkhus, Buddhist bhikkhus, because people have this, it's our natural human instinct to share. And this is about sharing, and it is about being dependent on other humans. But if we want to call that dependent on money, you know, you're free to say that.
You did make a comment, can we ever repay the sun? I thought that was a very poignant comment. You're listening to Central Standard on 89.3 KCUR, streaming live on KCUR.org. I'm your host, Jabalani LaFall. Our guest is Daniel Suelo, a man who lives in a cave and hasn't earned or spent a penny in about a decade. His life is the subject of the book, The Man Who Quit Money, written by Mark Sundin. Mark Sundin, there was a poison cactus incident that sort of addresses the question of getting hurt or dying alone in the wild with no money. Tell us about that, Mark.
Well, Daniel has lived for years partially off dumpster food and partially off of foraging in nature. And one evening he found a cactus, and he'd eaten plenty of cactus in the past, so he ate this one. And he made a bad decision. It turned out to be poison, and he got very sick, and he thought he was going to die. He was a two-hour walk from hospital or from town. He was out in the middle of the wilderness. And so he kind of wrote a little goodbye note, and then right about dawn he had a huge vomiting experience out the mouth of the cave, and then he was better, and so he didn't die. But it's, you know, it's one of those things that makes you realize how much we had come to rely on a safe food source. As Daniel was just talking about, you know, being a mooch, one thing I learned in the process of writing this book is that we as an Americans throw away 40% of the food we grow. And not only that, but once we throw the food away, we lock it up in our dumpsters so that people can't take it.
And that's a very interesting thing that comes out that shows the opulence and also the waste of our society.
And frankly, the greed.
And the greed. Daniel, do you keep up with the news, speaking of the greed and the opulence, do you keep up with the news and current events and kind of chuckle to yourself like, wow, this doesn't affect me at all. I don't want or need money, so none of this news affects me. Do you ever have that thought when you're keeping up with current events?
Yeah, I do. I go through phases. Like, sometimes I'll go months without knowing anything about the news. And then I go into civilization and I start listening to news, and it's fascinating to me. But then I think, wow, like, it's all the same. It's like, you know, it's sort of like the sun and the clouds. It's like, is it really affecting them? But I do go through phases where I'm totally fascinated with politics and current events, just because of the absurdity of it. It's so comical.
Right.
Hey, Daniel, are you registered to vote?
You know, actually, I need to check to see if I am, because I tried to vote in the last elections by absentee, and the ballot never came, and I don't know if I'm still registered.
But you don't pay taxes. Why would you vote?
Well, that is a good question.
I bet you never heard that one before. What do you hope? We're running short on time here. What do you hope people will take away from your story, Daniel Suelo?
Just to, like, even if you feel like you're trapped, that you can't live moneyless, one of the things is just practice generosity. Just freely give and freely receive. Right there, you are living without money. And not worry. It's like part of why I'm doing this, to show people that even if everything collapses, like when money collapses, everything collapses, it's not the end of the world. In fact, it opens up new doors and freedom and actually power. I feel like we have power when we're not chained down by our possessions and the world's mess. And instead, we get discouraged, and we think everything's gone. But that's where our power is, when everything's gone. That's when we find our true selves.
Our guest is Daniel Suelo, a man who lives in a cave on public lands in Utah, a cave he does not own, and travels sort of a modern-day sage, dumpster diving and volunteering and working for food, literally working for food, not holding a sign, but literally working for food and foraging, and hasn't earned a penny or spent a penny in about a decade. His life is the subject of a book, The Man Who Quit Money, and we're also joined by Mark Sundin, the author who wrote the book, The Man Who Quit Money. Thank you both for joining us today on Central Standard.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And tune in tomorrow when we talk with the Urban League of Greater Kansas City about their test prep development program. Today's show was produced by Danny Alexander with help from Maria Carter and Tamika Weatherspoon. Up to Date is next with a discussion on the Kansas City area development with Kevin Collison of the Kansas City Star. I'm Jabalani LaFall. This is Central Standard. Enjoy your day.